More Americans potentially exposed to the coronavirus coming to Texas amid concerns the disease could affect the Texas economy. That story and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Other stories we're tracking on this Monday. Some may think the opioid crisis is receding. Bexar County, though, is stepping up efforts to help treat those with addictions. We'll hear why. Also, the Trump administration calls for additional millions for quantum computing. What does it all add up to? A Texas expert does the math. And the story behind Bird City, Texas. All four of them. All that and then some when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 17th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown, and you know what tomorrow is, right? That guy in the back, sorry, bud, Valentine's was last week. Tomorrow is the 18th, which will be the first day for ballots to be cast in the presidential election season here in Texas. Early voting, they call it. And the eyes of the nation are on Texas, if the political news sites are any indication. Not just because of the number of delegates up for grabs either, though there's that too. Politico's reporter in the Texas capital city had an interesting write-up on Saturday. Here's the headline. Texas Dems sweat a Bernie Sanders ticket. To be honest, I'm giving you the family-friendly version of that headline. Such are the passions surrounding this story. It goes on to claim that veteran operatives here in Texas who see the possibility of flipping the Texas House of Representatives within arm's reach fear that nominating the Vermont senator and self-proclaimed Democratic socialist would not only squander an opportunity to take some state House seats, but make it harder in the long run for Texas Democrats because they'd be largely cut out of the redistricting process next year. Whether you buy this or not may largely depend upon whether you support Mr. Sanders in the primaries. Right now, the UT Texas Tribune poll says Sanders now leads the Democratic presidential candidates among Texas voters, and we note that. There's more in these numbers, too, about what is shaping up to be an interesting race for the U.S. Senate. Jim Henson is the director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas in Austin. He is one of the leaders of this poll, one of the brains behind it. Jim, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David. Happy to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about this latest polling that sort of bores in on the U.S. Senate race. This is John Cornyn's seat, right?
It is, and he's been there for a long time. He's held that seat since 2002, went into this seeming like a pretty formidable incumbent, although, you know, oddly enough, perhaps not as formidable as Ted Cruz seemed, and Ted Cruz had a real run for his money in 2018.
Is there anything in your polling numbers that suggest that John Cornyn could be in for a similar run for his political career here?
Well, a little bit. Cornyn has always been an unusually low-profile U.S. senator. His approval numbers and even his name recognition have been lower than the top-line Republicans like, say, Ted Cruz or certainly Greg Abbott. In the most recent poll, about a quarter of Texans don't really have an opinion of him. And when we ask about his job approval, and that's not the first time that we've seen that with Cornyn. I wouldn't call him vulnerable, but you know, there have always been some questions.
Well, this interesting stuff is happening on the Democratic side of this ledger, where you have a lot of people lined up hoping to take his place.
Yeah, it's a very crowded field, a dozen candidates on the Democratic side. MJ Hagar has broken out a little bit. You know, she's technically the front runner in the most recent poll with 22%. She's leading the pack. The nearest person, Christina Tinsun Ramirez, has 9%. But with that many people in the race, the problem is it's hard to clear the 50% threshold that you need for a runoff, to avoid a runoff.
So does this polling suggest that after the vote on March 3rd, we may be looking at indeed a runoff on the Democratic side of the ledger?
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard to avoid that. You would need MJ Hagar to really pour it on in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And to close that gap, I think, would be very difficult. And that's a tough break for the Democrats, because that means after the March 3rd primary, you wind up having to stretch out a runoff campaign into late May.
You mentioned Christina Sinsun Ramirez as sort of the number two at 9% in this polling. is it clear that Cristina Sinzun Ramirez would then be number two and somebody else? I mean, or does it break down that way?
No, I mean, I think I stopped in that list just because the list is so long. But, you know, Ramirez is followed by Chris Bell at 7%, Amanda Edwards at 6%, Dallas Senator Royce West at 6%, and Annie Mama Garcia and Sam Hernandez at 5% each. So you've got a bunch of people kind of right there in a clump in second place. Mm-hmm. Nobody in this race has broad statewide recognition. So I think it's a real toss-up who is going to emerge in that second spot, particularly given that, you know, without pushing people in the poll, when you first ask people what their preference is,
right,
about 50% of Democrats don't really want to make a choice.
Why do you think it is that there has not been a breakout candidate? I mean, when Beto O'Rourke took on Ted Cruz, I think very few people thought that he would be the sort of magnet that he became.
Well, I think there's a few things. One, there was no real, as you call Beto O'Rourke, a breakout candidate. And even before Beto O'Rourke became well-known, he was still getting a lot of media attention. I think it was a lot of anticipation that he was going to break out. Second, there is such a crowded field. And then third, just everybody in this race starts with a pretty low baseline. So you start with nobody having real name recognition among any more than a third of the electorate, and several of these candidates with much less.
Jim Henson is the director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, part of the UT Texas Tribune poll. Jim, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
You're welcome, as always. Thanks for having me.
Since 2017, a task force established in Bexar County has been trying to tackle what leaders there have called an opioid crisis. While the crisis isn't at the level that other parts of the country have experienced, the San Antonio Express News reports Bexar County does have a significant problem compared with other parts of the state. And recently, county commissioners approved several measures aimed at helping its citizens addicted to opioids. T.J. Mays is chair of Bexar County's opioid task force. Mr. Mays, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here with you.
The opioid crisis, I think, perhaps some of our listeners would feel, is sort of fallen out of the national spotlight of late. Maybe there have been other news events, but I think the perception is that we're sort of moving away from crisis mode and people are being held accountable for overprescribing and that sort of thing. Is the situation different in Bexar County?
Well, there has been a significant effort to cramp down on overprescription, but there have been several waves to this crisis. So there's still a lot of heroin use. There's still a lot of fentanyl overdose deaths. And we're also seeing people mixing opioid drugs with methamphetamines and other stimulants. So we are in a new wave of the crisis, but it's not the same crisis that it was 4 or 5 years ago.
So the proposals that Bexar County commissioners took action on, did they come from your desk?
Yes. The Commissioner's Court created what we call the Bexar County Opioid Task Force in 2017, and we've been working diligently with public health professionals, medical professionals, law enforcement, and detention officers and academics to develop a comprehensive solution tailored to Bexar County's needs.
I understand there are four initiatives that commissioners have approved. What are they?
So the first is a measure that would help with neonatal abstinence syndrome. Bexar County leads the state in neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is when a baby is born with withdrawal symptoms because the mother was using an opioid during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. We have what's called Casa Mia here, which is a partnership between the state, the UT Health School of Nursing, and other local partners, which provides recovery support housing for the mothers and the babies. There's an instinct to take the babies away from the mothers, mm-hmm. but that's not in the best interest of the baby, the mother, or our community. So the Casa Mia is an innovative program. We have funding for a year, but we want to get more sustainable funding. So that was the first measure we adopted.
Something that a lot of people have been talking about is a plan to help jail inmates in Bexar County, right? This will treat more than 60 inmates with Vivitrol?
Studies have found that someone is most vulnerable to an opioid overdose right when they leave incarceration. What's emerged as a best practice nationally is offering medication-assisted treatment in detention settings. This has been shown to reduce overdose and reduce recidivism. So it's the right thing to do, and it saves taxpayer monies. There are three different kinds of medication-assisted treatment that are available, approved by the FDA, and Vivitrol is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Vivitrol in the jail is a first step toward a best practice, which is offering all three FDA-approved medications within the jail, which is our ultimate goal.
Where's the money coming from for this initiative?
We hope the money comes from the state, but we have other options. We have a grant proposal into the governor's office, which is what the commissioner's court approved on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But we'll have a program either way.
Okay, you've talked about two of these four initiatives. Briefly, what are the other two?
Another initiative is what we call a peer recovery system for people whose lives have been saved by naloxone. Naloxone is an anti-overdose drug when mm-hmm. someone's overdosing.
Right.
It reverses the overdose. About 1,800 doses are administered by EMS personnel in San Antonio every year. And we have a program where peer recovery coaches will follow up within a day with someone whose life has been saved and steer them toward treatment. So this is a partnership between the San Antonio Council on Alcohol and Drug Awareness, UT Health School of Nursing, and of course, the San Antonio Fire Department. The last initiative is what we're calling CARES, which is a collective impact model to address substance abuse more broadly in our community. San Antonio is not unlike other parts of the state or the country in that there are issues with more stimulant use, there's issues with more alcohol use, and there are more deaths from each of these substances. So the UT Health Long School of Medicine right here in San Antonio will be based a collective impact, which we're calling CARES, which will support research, advocacy, and other programs that will help us tackle the substance abuse epidemic more broadly. So it's really an outgrowth from the task force.
We're going to have a link to more details about this program over at texasstandard.org. TJ Mays is chair of Bexar County's Opioid Task Force. Mr. Mays, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me. We appreciate it.
The Bexar County used to be your stomping ground, Michael Marks.
Once upon a time, yeah. Yes, sir.
Michael Marks covering the talk of Texas monitoring social media on this holiday. Happy President's Day.
Happy President's Day to you. Are we going to rank them later?
I don't know. I'll leave that up to you.
Second
How about
half of the
that?
Show?
Yeah.
We definitely did hear about the latest poll from the University of Texas and the Texas Tribune, mm-hmm. taking the temperature of that Democratic primary yeah. race. As we heard, veteran MJ Hager appears to be leading the pack. Then there is a big pile up with pretty much everybody else, according to this poll. Notably, David, top vote getter was other, with 34%, indicating folks may not be paying super close attention just yet. That's evidenced by Emiliano Diaz de León, who says, I'm a Texas Democrat. Who's MJ Hager? Didn't even know she was running. Might be an opportunity to learn a little bit more. I think we'll have a plug for that later in the show.
Yeah, you ought to go over to texasstandard.org and do some fishing around. I bet we're going to have some terrific links here about the Senate race over there. We're going to be back. I should say Michael Marks is going to be back in about 35 minutes with more of the talk of Texas. We're going to be back with more news right after this.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology. With more than 210 cancer centers across the state, patients can access technology, research, and treatment options in their local communities. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's been 2.5 years since Hurricane Harvey, and yet many homeowners are still dealing with mold, warped floorboards, and electrical problems. Well, now there's a new group, the Harvey Forgotten Survivors Caucus. They say they're frustrated with the city of Houston and its efforts to distribute federal money. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports.
When Lawrence Hester and his wife Jacqueline recently opened their home to guests, we all had to wear masks to breathe. With at least half of the house full of mold, they lived in the front three rooms for over 2 years, up until December, when a nonprofit organization moved them to a safe apartment. The storm seriously damaged the roof. The ceiling collapsed in their daughter's bedroom. Other rooms are damaged too, the bathroom, the kitchen.
What this used to look like, this was a nice kitchen. I mean, before, do you see the walls here where the mold has actually set in, the flooring is set in because water is standing underneath the home.
Jacqueline says her husband has lived in the house his entire life.
59 years. Lauren's parents purchased this home in 1961 when he was a newborn baby.
They say the home never flooded until Harvey. They didn't have flood insurance. After the storm, Jacqueline says they reached out to FEMA for help.
FEMA came out and looked at the roof and he said, we can only assist you with just a portion to get the roof repaired, not replaced, just repaired.
FEMA gave them $3,000. Jacqueline says not enough to fix the whole roof. Kurt Pickering is a spokesperson with FEMA.
You know, as a surprise to folks sometimes, because they kind of expect that the government is going to put things back the way they were, that's not the government's role, that's insurance's role.
So Jacqueline called the city.
They refer me to 411, 211, 311. Well, we don't have any funds, we can't help you, that's not in our, we don't cover that, or let me give you to another company that might can help you with your roof. When I call that company, we're booked up.
They told her, we have your information, we have your photos.
It was just phone call after phone call after phone call after phone call. And after 2.5 years, 3 years, you pretty much get overwhelmed. You know, we just didn't know who else to reach out to.
Eventually, the Forgotten Survivors Caucus got involved. And when I visited the house, Houston's housing director, Tom McCaslin, was there with the rest of us looking at the damage.
He was very apologetic. You know, I'm sorry it came to this, but if this is what it takes to open our eyes, this is what it have to take for us to come out and do a tour of your home. And he said, no one should live in this condition.
We reached out to the city housing department to ask about participants in the repair program, and they didn't give us an interview. But it's frustration with how repair money is being distributed that led to the formation of the caucus, especially after some of the same homes were flooded again in Tropical Storm Imelda, says Zoe Middleton with Texas Housers, an advocacy group.
And this caucus is as much about improving the program and building power for low and moderate income survivors as it is providing emotional support.
One of their demands is for more mental health services to be part of disaster recovery.
Because of the toll that living in a disrepaired home or bouncing between places or being displaced can have on folks.
Middleton says the Hester's house is typical. Most of these homes still have serious damage.
We've been following the outcomes of the program since it began. That was a little over a year ago. We're feeling really frustrated.
She told me the caucus is hoping to have a meeting with the housing department next month. As for the Hesters, they've given up on waiting for help from the city, and they're working with a nonprofit to make their home livable. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. If not here on the big broadcast, you've likely heard other places through other reports about the impact and potential spread of the coronavirus. Something that perhaps less attention is paid to is how it could spread to the Texas economy. Here to help us understand how, Energy Insider Matt Smith, he's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
We can picture what's happening in China right now. So much attention being focused on trying to deal with the spread of the disease itself. Mm-hmm. You've got demand from China certainly falling through the floor there, right?
Yeah, that's right. So one good indicator really has been, or well, three good indicators, has been monthly reports out of three key bodies last week. Mm-hmm. And we had from the IEA, they said that oil demand growth is expected to contract on a global basis for the first quarter in over 10 years.
Wow.
And that's, you know, since the belly of the Great Recession. So that gives you an idea of the impact it's having here. At the same time as well, you've had OPEC and the EIA. The EIA is the U.S. Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
They took an axe essentially to their 2020 expectations, cutting demand growth. EIA was by 300,000 barrels a day. OPEC was less than that, sort of 230,000 barrels a day. All that said, though, David, oil demand growth for this year is still expected to come in around the ballpark of 1 million barrels a day.
So what does that tell you? I mean, how does 1 million barrels a day compare with previous years, those of us who've not been following the charts?
Sure. It's a little less than what we've seen in recent years, but it's still holding up pretty well. So typically it's up about 1.3, 1.2, something like that. So you're seeing that immediate dent from the coronavirus being priced in or reflected in those demand growth expectations.
Mm-hmm. So what's this doing to oil prices? I mean, I know prices at the pump have been lower from what I can tell, but what's mm-hmm. the big picture here?
Well, oil prices, they're very emotional from the perspective that they tend to front run events. So what we saw was this with this dent to demand coming. We saw it priced in very quickly into prices. We saw oil prices drop by $10 a barrel from the start of January into early February. But since then, we've seen them ticking ever so gradually higher in the last week or two. They're holding fairly steady around that $50 a barrel price mark. Essentially, they're in a holding pattern here, just waiting to see what happens next before they make a move.
Texas's economy is much more diversified than it was, just 10 years ago. But you could go back even further and say, wow, look at how much has changed. Nonetheless, mm-hmm. the Lone Star State relies a lot on revenue from the oil industry. It's sort of its economic backbone. How do you see what's playing out there, especially vis-a-vis demand from China? How do you see that playing out in the Permian and for the Texas economy writ large?
Well, it's going to have a ripple effect. And so, you know, the US is the largest economy in the world. China is the second largest. You know, they say when China sneezes, the world catches a cold. Mm. So there is going to be an impact on the US and specifically on Texas as well. What we're likely to see is a number of these economic indicators coming out over the coming weeks and months, showing slowing economic activity, not just in China, but elsewhere in Asia, and then likely back to the US too, unfortunately.
And what about the larger economic data? Are you seeing any slowdowns that might affect the oil markets?
Yes, we're seeing early signs that are pointing to a sharp downturn in manufacturing and in trade. And so we're already seeing a drop in jet fuel deliveries and also a drop in the number of scheduled container vessel port calls worldwide. And so that's starting to reflect that slowing economic activity. And unfortunately, that could really permeate across the globe.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. He's been tracking the ups and downs of the markets. Matt, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us again on the Texas Standard, and we'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Barrazas. The chief medical officer of a San Antonio hospital that's treating a patient who tested positive for the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, is assuring the public they are safe. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
Methodist Healthcare Chief Medical Officer Paul Hancock says Methodist Texan is among several hospitals in the area that is always ready for a patient with an infectious disease.
We have the personalized protective equipment that is necessary, and we have staff that are familiar in the use of the personalized protective equipment.
In fact, Methodist Texan was built with 7 rooms which can switch to negative pressure if a patient tests positive for an infectious disease. That means air flows into the room, but flows out into a separate ventilation system, protecting everyone else in the hospital from, in this case, a virus. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
The patient was among an initial group of 91 American evacuees from China under federal quarantine at Lackland Air Force Base. Early this morning, a new set of evacuees arrived at Lackland. They were passengers on the Diamond Princess cruise ship and had been quarantined on board near Japan due to an outbreak of coronavirus. Today, Governor Greg Abbott is kicking off a statewide tour to campaign for fellow Republicans running for seats in the Texas House of Representatives. The candidates in the March 3rd primary include incumbents, those running for open seats, and others hoping to flip Democratic-held districts. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more on where Abbott is headed.
His first stop is in Highland Village in North Texas, but according to the Texas Tribune, he plans to go around the state to help get out the vote for other candidates representing Victoria, Baytown, Katy, as well as Waxahachie and Frisco. At the end of the week, Abbott is also expected to hold a joint event for 3 Texas Republicans in Southeast Texas.
In Highland Village tonight, Abbott is campaigning for Kronda Timich. She's facing another Republican in the primary in the hopes of ultimately challenging the Democratic incumbent, State Representative Michelle Beckley. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred says he considered stripping the Houston Astros of their 2017 World Series title after an investigation revealed the team stole opponents' pitching signs. Manfred told ESPN Sunday one reason he ultimately decided against that punishment was because there's no precedent for it.
Number two, I thought that the report gave people a really transparent account of what went on, that we put people in a position to make their own judgments about the behavior that went on.
The Astros were fined a maximum penalty of $5 million for the cheating scheme, among other punishment. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. Ever been to Bird City, Texas? I bet you have. You just didn't know it. Truth is, you could be forgiven for not realizing that four rather well-known cities can now claim the mantle of Bird City, Texas, because it's not so much a proper name as it is a new designation by Texas Parks and Wildlife. Richard Heilbrunn is an urban wildlife program leader who's been overseeing this project. Richard, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be here.
What are the four Texas communities that have made it into the inaugural Bird City, Texas certification?
We're really proud of these communities. We have Port Aransas, Dallas, Houston, and Bastrop.
I have to tell you, I'm a little bit surprised that Dallas and Houston, being the big cities they are on this list. I get Port A, baby, and Bastrop, we have to loop back there. But how is it that Houston and Dallas wound up on this list?
Well, those communities are doing a lot of things for bird conservation and wildlife in general. They have committed resources in terms of people and programs. They organize people together to teach their residents about birds and bird management. And so they've brought the full force of all their resources to improve their community for birds.
You know, a couple of these cities, Port A and Houston, were both rather hard hit by Hurricane Harvey. Was that a factor here in the certification process?
What was a factor in their certification is how they responded to those disasters. And both communities have used their wild places as not just bird habitat, but as a way to absorb the impacts of those catastrophic floods. So in Port Aransas, what we found was that their preserve systems were pretty well devastated after Hurricane Harvey, but they decided to invest in the restoration of that preserve system so that it continues to provide excellent bird habitat. That's pretty hard for such a small community, and they made the hard choice to do that. Houston was hit by Hurricane Harvey, and what they noticed was that their parkland, their bayou system, served as a sponge for a lot of that water. And so as it sat on those parklands, it was not inundating the neighborhoods. And so they recognized the value of that bayou system in a natural state. So they're choosing to restore the bayou system and preserve the bayou system so that it benefits both people and birds.
Why did Texas Parks and Wildlife decide to do this? I gather there's a partnership with the National Audubon Society here.
Parks and Wildlife is partnering with Texas Audubon to encourage conservation across the state. And so when we have these communities that are doing such great things, we want to hold them up as examples of what more communities can do to engage people with nature, to welcome birds into their communities and make conscious decisions at the city level to improve their lands for wildlife, acquire more parks, and manage their creeks and the rivers for the benefit of those native birds.
Other than bragging rights, getting to call yourself one of the Bird City, Texas cities, what does this designation mean as a practical matter?
Bragging rights are really important, and we're
I don't want to downplay that, but I bet you there's might mean more tourism or maybe getting grants or something.
That is what it means. In fact, we're already seeing the four communities that received the certification are advertising themselves to those bird watchers, to those nature photographers, as a tourist destination. So this certification may help them get more heads in beds and more dollars in their antique shops and in their restaurants as people make those decisions to come to their community to see the birds.
Now I'm thinking that there might be some smaller towns that might want to take advantage of such a certification, especially if it could mean not just more birds, but perhaps more tourists. So how do cities compete for certification, or are they competing, in fact?
they're not competing against each other, but they are competing against themselves. And so what we ask them to do is tell us what they're doing and have they met 26 of 56 possible different criteria and what have they done already? And then what are they committing to do for the next 3 years? So they have to take a very deep look at what they're doing and an inventory of the kinds of lands and habitat and bird life that they already have. And then they have to manage those lands and make decisions of policy and education and engagement with their people that benefits birds.
We're going to have more on the process over at texasstandard.org. Richard Heilbrun is an urban wildlife program leader with Texas Parks and Wildlife, deeply involved in the Bird City, Texas certification program. Congratulations to all four cities, and congratulations to you too, Mr. Heilbrun. Thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Holy smokes. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Can't believe where the time has gone. We're going to be checking in with the Talk of Texas, Michael Marks, in just a couple of minutes. Keep your comments coming.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. SNCC. In the 1960s, the acronym for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was always in the news, it seemed. More than a half a century later, the group, first formed to give younger African Americans more of a voice in pushing for civil rights, continues its work. But an exhibit at the Bullock Museum, The Story of Texas, takes us back in time, helping us to see through the eyes of some of the earliest activists, the story of the struggle in the 1960s against segregation, race-based disenfranchisement, and Jim Crow. Maria Varela was there. She was the first Latina woman to document the 1960s civil rights struggle in the Black Belt South. Her work is featured in This Light of Ours, Activist Photographers of the Civil Rights Movement. Ms. Varela, it's an honor to welcome you to the Texas Standard. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
How did you first get involved in SNCC? Were you a young student? Reluctantly, yeah.
Are you kidding me? It was like so scary.
Were you a student at the time or what?
I just left my student years, yeah, just graduated.
Uh-huh.
And was invited down to work in the SNCC headquarters in Atlanta.
Right.
Which I kept this letter in my suitcase for 4 months because I was an organizer for the Young Christian Students, which is a Catholic social action movement. And we were, among the things we were doing in 1960 was talking to students about supporting the sit-ins and the civil rights movement in the South. And then I got this letter from a friend of mine saying, we could really use your help down here at headquarters. I had very good secretarial skills. That's what women did, right?
Is that what you thought you would be doing?
Well, yeah. That's what I was recruited to do.
Oh.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone. I was like too scared, you know, with between the Klan and local sheriffs and bugs and spiders. I mean, who'd want to do that? And one thing led to another, and I didn't really pick up a camera till 1965, because by then I had evolved to doing adult literacy materials, which in my mind, the thing to do was to feature local organizations that were really making breakthroughs, mm-hmm. led by Black people, because nobody knew about that. And I could do adult basic education books showing through pictures and words, Black people making change in their community.
But here's the thing, and I think that this has been said repeatedly, this isn't a new idea, but that the pictures, the images from that struggle were so crucial to the changing of minds in the 60s, and frankly, even today. I mean, when you think about how smartphones, images are being used in current, Black Lives Matter, for example.
Right.
Did you have any sense that by picking up that camera, you'd be sort of assuming a whole new role that would in a way, animate?
Well, you ask a soldier in the foxhole if he knows the effect the war is having on the nation or on the world, because you don't know. You're just there doing the work. And basically, I had no idea. None of us did, you know. And if you're talking about the media's propensity to feature pictures that if it bleeds, it leads. Well, yeah. The plus side is it did, I think, shake people up and wake them up. The minus side is that people think the civil rights movement was that. Marches, protests, that was 15% of what we did on any given day, in any given place, in the Deep South, in the Southern Freedom Movement, was protests and marches. The rest of it was the hard work of building infrastructures that were trying to deconstruct apartheid and Jim Crow laws and make life better for people in the communities. That's what they wanted. So it's a two-edged sword.
I was thinking about the fact that there's something else, another function that certainly photography did, and I guess I wonder how directly you felt this. And it's basically to document the use of force against protesters, right? I mean, were you conscious of that role that you would assume as a photographer?
We were told to do that. We had an executive director, Jim Foreman, who was trained. He was a trained historian. And Jim really felt that SNCC's work was cutting edge and needed to be documented. And that's why we had 9 photographers on staff. And there wasn't really any other civil rights movement that had that. We had 2 dark rooms, one in Atlanta and one in Mississippi that I had put together and ran. So definitely that was a part of what we were doing. We utilized the technology of the day. We put these posters up that just flew out the door, and they were all over, not just in college dorms. They were on front porches in Jackson, Mississippi, you know, where Black people pretty much live. It was like a symbol of defiance to put up a SNCC poster. And so our images, we were conscious about how we use them in the Student Voice, which was the only newspaper that came out of the Deep South movement and was distributed all across campuses in this country with images from SNCC photographers.
Let's talk a little bit more about the exhibit proper. Is there an image in the exhibit that you would say I don't want to say favorite, because favorite connotes something completely different, but is there an image that you believe is most powerful, at least to you?
Well, that's like asking which kid do you like the best.
Of course,
but
yeah.
I think the one image that I'm always drawn to, and I can't remember the photographer who took it, it's a SNCC organizer walking up the railroad track bed doing his door-to-door, because that was my experience in the movement, was all that organizing that went on day-to-day to kind of build whatever the people in the community wanted. So I think that that's one of my favorites.
We're out of time, but I want to ask about the role of an exhibit like this, given where the movement that is ongoing, how this plays a role, because it strikes me that there is a bit of a danger anytime you're talking about something that is continuing, being part of an exhibit in a museum, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a danger, or is there a way that perhaps this exhibit sort of transcends the notion that this is something that happened in the past?
Well, and that does need somebody talking about it, because it's difficult just to make this assumption. But what I take out of this is that there are 3 products that came from this movement in terms that I think belong in any follow-up movements. And the first one is representation. Who speaks for the voiceless? And the second one is decision-making. Who decides? And you see a lot of collaboration going on in parts of this exhibit of people working together to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is who benefits? Because the bottom line is, if the people who started this movement or on whose behalf was started are not benefiting, then it's gone awry. It's strayed from its core responsibilities.
And those are matters that speak to the present as much as they do the past.
Absolutely.
We've been speaking with Maria Varela. She is an activist and photographer whose work is featured in This Light of Ours, Activist Photographers of the Civil Rights Movement, on display now at the Bullock, Texas State History Museum. Ms. Varela, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule to speak with us on the Texas Standard. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Trump administration's fiscal year 2021 budget proposal includes a significant boost in funding for artificial intelligence and quantum computing, even as the budget would significantly cut overall R&D spending. If Congress goes along with it, AI funding would nearly double and quantum computing would get a 50% boost over last year's budget, doubling in 2022 to $860 million. The administration says these two fields of research are important to U.S. national security. You know why, right? China invests heavily in these areas, too. Well, one person with definite ideas about what the U.S. should be doing to further quantum computing science is Scott Aronson. He's a professor of computer science and the founding director of the Quantum Information Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Aronson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
I'm sure you get asked this question quite a bit, but can you explain what quantum computing actually is?
Sure. A 30-second version. A quantum computer is a device that would exploit the laws of quantum mechanics, which have been the basis for physics since the 1920s, in order to solve certain problems, very special problems, much, much faster than we know how to solve them with any conventional computer.
It appears that the Trump administration sees this as rather critical, at least in having a competitive advantage over China. What is it about solving physics problems that would give the United States such a competitive advantage?
Well, the biggest applications that we know of for a quantum computer are things like simulating chemistry and physics in order to design new materials, potentially, new drugs, new superconductors, solar cells, all kinds of things like that.
But, you know, I thought that Google and IBM and these private companies, mm-hmm. I mean, they've been making massive investments in this sort of computing, right? Why does the federal government need to put in more money?
Well, I think that basic research, you know, remains extremely important in this field. I mean, for one thing, we do not yet know how to build a full scalable quantum computer. The quantum computing version of the transistor, if you like, has not been invented yet. You know, and then there are the algorithms. We still have only a few applications where a quantum computer is known to give us a big advantage over what we know how to do classically. You know, and that's often misrepresented in the popular press, where it's claimed that a quantum computer is just a magic box that does everything, right?
Right.
You know, and we continue to discover new applications for these things. And actually, you know, the people at Google and IBM and so forth, they are in conversation with academia about, you know, once we succeed in building these things, what do we do with them? That's interesting.
Well, now, getting back to this U.S.-China fulcrum, which does seem to sort of dominate a lot of these discussions around quantum computing, is the essential push economic, or is it one of national security, or what exactly as you see it?
Well, I think there are some of both. Maybe the most notorious application for a quantum computer, which was discovered 25 years ago, is that if you can build a truly scalable error-corrected one, then it could break almost all of the encryption that is currently used to protect the internet. So anytime you order something from Amazon, you know, your credit card number is being protected by a code that depends on the belief that it is hard to find the prime factors of enormous numbers or a few other mathematical problems like that. A quantum computer could solve those problems.
As people talk about quantum computing, as it becomes something that is more popularized, I suppose you could say, like AI is these days, how far off are we from that magic box?
Well, as I said, we already, as of a few months ago, have quantum computers that can outperform any classical computer on Earth for a few very, very, very special tasks. Now, of course, you know what I assume you mean by your question is, when will we have quantum computers that are truly useful, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, hopefully we're going to start seeing the first useful applications over the next decade. Now, initially, they're going to be very specialized ones. So the way I put it is that, you know, we are now entering the very, very early vacuum tube era of quantum computers. Now, the real goal is to get to what's called an error-corrected quantum computer, which is one that you could scale up to as many qubits as you need, you know, run for as long as you need. That we don't know. I mean, some people think it could be done within a decade. You know, other people think several decades. I mean, you know, I just hope our civilization lasts long enough. You know, if it does, I think, sure, you know, eventually we'll get all of this.
Scott Aronson directs UT Austin's Quantum Information Center. He's also the author of the book Quantum Computing Since Democritus. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Of course, it was a pleasure.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Once again, Michael Marks joins us back here in the studio covering the talk of Texas. What do the folks on social media have to say on this Monday, Michael?
Early voting starts tomorrow, David, so yeah. It is endorsement season. For so long, the local paper would endorse candidates for every race on the ballot, many of them still doing that. But at the very top of the ticket, two big Texas papers gone in another direction. That's generated some discussion.
Say more.
Last week, the San Antonio Express News editorial board announced that, and I'm quoting here, after much consideration, Express News publisher Michael Sachs has chosen not to make a presidential recommendation. Then yesterday, Dallas Morning News' editorial board wrote that they, too, would decline to endorse a specific candidate. Instead, again quoting, rather than making a presidential recommendation, we will endorse ideas. Rather than recommending one candidate, we will offer a vision for the country. So there's going to be a series of articles to come about the specific policies they'd like to see. Over on the Texas Standard Facebook page, Mark Fisher says, what a cop-out, which is one reaction.
Calling it as he sees it,
Dennis Gray writes in part, nobody cares about newspapers and editorial boards.
Ouch.
And on Twitter, user Wendell Barnhouse writes that the paper also recognizes The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet as the nation's most popular television show, a reference to the idea you see quite a lot this time of year, that maybe these types of endorsements are a bit outdated. I mean, it's certainly a conversation that people are having. Should newspapers still be making recommendations? And even if they do, do they affect any votes? Does anybody care?
Yeah, does it move the needle? I think it's kind of interesting, though, that we still talk about, like, for instance, what the New York Times, Washington
right.
Post editors pick. And sometimes that becomes newsworthy unto itself. So, I mean, I don't know. I take the points that are being made by the listeners there. What do you think? I mean, do you think, dear listener, that we should, that it's okay for newspapers to be endorsing? And what value does it bring to you? We'd love to hear from you. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice.
A conversation for the program, perhaps. Real quick, David, an idea basketball fans endorse. The NBA All-Star game was last night. I am a huge NBA fan, and I will tell you, like most fans, I do not care about the All-Star game in and of itself.
No?
Historically, it's a snooze fest. The players don't play hard. There's no defense. Not entertaining. Last night was different, though, because of a rule change. Instead of the fourth quarter being timed, the NBA took the leading team score and added 24 points to it. That's a nod to Kobe Bryant, wore the number 24. Whichever team got there first was the winner. So in this case, it was first to 157 points wins, no matter how long it takes. And it worked. It was super, super entertaining.
Wow.
The best players in the world playing hard. Worth noting that James Harden made the two free throws to put his team in front for good. And lots of folks love this idea. CP3 sticks. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. Lawson Houston. NBA did a great job. I hope they keep doing it because people seem to love it online.
That's really exciting. It's hard to imagine somebody not taking it seriously when you throw Kobe Bryant's name.
That's fair.
For sure. Michael Marks covering the talk of Texas on this Monday. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.